Okay. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. Thank you so much to everyone who has joined us today. This is Catalyzing Change, and it's a panel on how philanthropy can be kind of a driving force in climate tech innovation. So I'm going to introduce myself, and then I'll allow our panelists to go ahead and introduce themselves. My name is Courtney Newell. I'm the Senior Director of Development at an organization called Activate Global. We're a nonprofit, and we run an entrepreneurial fellowship for scientists. So basically, we work with scientists who are generally, not exclusively, at the end of maybe a PhD or a postdoc, they've developed a really innovative and potentially super high impact hard technology. So pretty much everything but software, we say. And they think that this thing could really change the world if they could get it out of the lab and into a small business, a new business, a product, and take it to scale in the market. And that's super, super hard to do. And so where we come in is we both identify, and then we work with these scientists for 2 years to help them develop those ideas, develop the entrepreneurial skill set they need to become scientist CEOs, and then take those companies to scale. And we've been around for 8 years. Some of our climate tech companies are the alumni now and are some of the biggest names out there. We're very, very proud of them. They've collectively raised almost $2 billion in follow-on funding. And every year we're bringing 40, 50 new scientists into the world and launching them out as small businesses. So we're very proud of that. And today we want to talk with one of the most important sources of our support and support in general for climate change, the philanthropy world, to understand what's the role, where are the opportunities, where are the blockages, how can philanthropy play a unique role in driving forward that innovation and also the commercialization of that innovation so that it actually gets out in the world and does something and doesn't stay stuck in a lab. So I'll take a beat and I'll allow our panelists now to go ahead and introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Olivia Strader. I'm a senior associate at LH Capital / Lyda Hill Philanthropies. So we serve as the family office for Lyda Hill, who is one of the first signers of the Giving Pledge and has pledged to give away a little more than the majority, but all of her wealth by the time of her passing. And so I get the fun job of both investing and giving away capital across nature and science. And so how that applies here is really investing across grants to investments in climate tech and making sure that they can scale from research all the way to commercialization. And what we really try to do is make sure that we're using the best and most creative capital tools to drive impact and change. And so in climate tech, there's a whole world out there that we're still exploring. And we've learned a lot from biotech and are now applying it to climate tech.
Hey, everyone. My name is Margaret Lee. I work as the manager of partnership strategy for an organization called Prime Coalition. We are a nonprofit, but what we do is we are on a mission to unlock catalytic capital to transform climate finance. So we've worked with over 250 different philanthropists over the first 10 years of our funding to mobilize over $300 million in catalytic capital towards early stage climate solutions. This is one capital gap that we've been tackling in partnership with many of the folks here in the room, I'm sure, and also with the people up here on the stage. And we're also excited about addressing a next capital gap between the gap between venture capital and project finance. So we think a lot about creativity in terms of not just the money out, how we're investing the money, but also the money in. What are the different sort of philanthropic tools that we can use to unlock catalytic capital?
Hi, I'm Pat McGrath. I'm the program director for climate tech with the Schmidt Family Foundation. This is the foundation founded by Eric and Wendy Schmidt. It's a pretty broad portfolio in the Family Foundation, from human rights to oceans to ag to energy. My lens on is I'm coming from a technology development side. My career has been in energy R&D. I'm a chemical engineer by training, came from a background of batteries and fuel cells, but over my career I've become something of a generalist. I've done everything from nuclear fusion to biofuels. My purview with the foundation, we're looking for ways to support scalable technologies for hard-to-abate sectors. And as Margaret already alluded, one of the most important pieces that we're looking to tackle is the scaling gap of when we get a technology past the is this even possible stage, getting it to the scaled and into the real world stage is a real bottleneck or barrier or whatever metaphor we choose that we're looking to help tackle.
Awesome. Thanks, y'all. And thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited about this group. We were just kind of chit-chatting through what we're going to talk about today in the back there, and it was just a fascinating conversation already. This is the perfect group, I think, to have this conversation. And we really appreciate y'all joining us. And the first thing I want to ask, and so in one of the prep calls that we had, I was saying, I talk to a lot of philanthropists all day, and a lot of them are, they use the phrase, I really want to get into climate. And you're like, okay. That's a lot. That's a big ask because it's a really complicated space, and there's a lot of first of their kind technologies going on, and there's a lot of ways for philanthropies to get into climate. So the first question, and it's kind of a broad one, but I would love to just kind of have y'all take it where you will, is how can philanthropic organizations or philanthropists leverage their unique role to catalyze climate tech? And I think in particular, I'd love to hear what, well, the operative word might be their unique role. Like, what is that unique role and where is the opportunity gap that philanthropies can really help fill? So Olivia, would you mind leading us off?
Yeah. So I would view a philanthropist as someone who's not only deploying capital, but has convening power as well. And so philanthropy can come into a room and bring together not only NGOs, but government officials, venture capitalists, all sorts of different table building. And so that's really the role that we can play outside of just capital. With that being said, capital is really important because we can be really creative. We're not necessarily, there's returns driven on the investment side, but on the philanthropic side, it's making sure it drives the most impact and scale. And so how you do that might look different, whether that's a grant, whether that's a loan, whether that's investment capital. And so philanthropy has the opportunity to kind of be the most creative person in the room, but also be a table builder and make sure that all different stakeholders are there to make sure that the solutions not only are built, de-risked, but also can scale.
Yeah, I'd add that what I love about philanthropy is that it can really de-risk a lot of things that other types of capital can't. So something that we've built at Prime Coalition is a blended fund called Azula Ventures. And that is a $239 million fund that combines both catalytic and what we call full cycle capital. So we have about one third of that is charitable capital in the eyes of the IRS. And then the other two thirds of it is mission aligned and impact aligned capital. But it can be take the form of mission related investments or program related investments. So not just thinking about what is the actual type of capital that you're using, but also what are the different funding mechanisms that you can use and being open to that. I think that's really the thing for me about philanthropy is recognizing the power that you have as a philanthropist and using that to unlock things that otherwise wouldn't come to scale.
Definitely. Yeah, Pat, go ahead.
I don't want to repeat, but I would just like to double click on the convening power and also just recognizing there is an ecosystem. I talk about the scaling gap as a big problem, but I don't think it's the role for philanthropy to write the check for a $200 million facility. I think it's to work with the ecosystem and the downstream funders who could make these things happen at scale. So I do think it's important to recognize, like, don't try to boil the ocean. It's not going to work. But identify what are the gaps, the bottlenecks that you can with, while there's a lot of philanthropic capital available, it's not enough to solve all of the problems. So look for the points of leverage.
Definitely. I really love that collaborative mindset of how are we doing what we do, but how are we doing it in concert with the other important players. And I think that's something we're going to talk about a little bit more later. Next, I really would love to hear, because I want to build off of something you said, Margaret, you've got a lot of capital, you guys are deploying, you have a really interested blended model. How are you prioritizing which things you're investing in to maximize impact? This is a huge question in philanthropy because, like you said, Olivia, it's not about just pure returns. Essentially, the return philanthropy is looking for is impact. So how are we maximizing that? And there's so many different things that we need to do right now to address climate. How are we putting those in some sort of priority order?
Yeah, totally. I can speak to the different investment criteria that we have at Prime. And I will also say Prime is a nonprofit, and we have built and launched funds underneath the nonprofit that have spun out. So Azula Ventures is a standalone company currently that spun out in October of 2021. When I'm speaking about the investment criteria, I'm talking about that as a collaboration between Prime and Azula specifically, and then also some of the work that we are looking towards in the bridging the gap between climate project finance and venture. So the way we prioritize things at Prime is around three different investment criteria: gigaton scale climate impact potential. That's very hard to measure. And just even scope. additionality, which is this wouldn't be funded but for a philanthropic intervention. And the third one is commercialization, essentially. So there's a bridge to somewhere. So when we're thinking about the role that philanthropy can play, we're also thinking about not just what the role and the intervention that is happening, but also about where to go after that. So it's thinking about what happens at the point of intervention, point in time. This company wouldn't otherwise be funded but for us, but also what do we want to see happen after that?
Excellent. Would Olivia and Pat, you want to add anything?
I guess actually to follow on the additionality question, so one piece, just want to acknowledge, I think this is like a really, really, really hard question to answer. Like, it's philosophically impossible to prove. Like, we're talking about what would happen if you didn't do this. Like, we can't actually answer that question. So I do think what Prime has done exceptionally well is set up a system to really poke down and make sure it's like, we're not just throwing money at something that was going to happen with or without us. And that's important. But the other piece, and I don't know that, I think you've been really good on the ecosystem if you zoom out. The but for what Prime did for the early stage stuff and the ecosystem that's grown up for now, really, truly bleeding edge early stage stuff that wasn't quite ready to be a company, getting it over the hump where they could plausibly go out and raise funding. I think it's important to look at the ecosystem there. And it's like we can zoom in on this individual case and wrap ourselves around the axle about would this thing happen with or without us. But I think it's important to also just look at all of the players at different stages in the ecosystem to say, is there a problem here? Is there a bottleneck here? And I think in the case, what Activate is doing, what Prime is doing, what's growing up, you know, like, let's give some shout outs. There's lots of people out on the stage. Elemental Accelerator is doing like tremendous work in this space too. The early stage has come a really, really long way in the last 5 years. And I think that the additionality of having tackled the earliest stage piece is like, without question, we've done something there. And I do think it's important to zoom out and just acknowledge that within the overall system, that this philanthropic intervention made a difference. Even if on each individual case, it's hard to answer that question, at the system level, it absolutely did.
Yeah, let me add a little bit more on additionality because it's so hard. It's a point-in-time assessment. That's how we approach it at Prime. And some of the things that are really important about the Prime models that we build in third-party governance. So we convene a subset of folks who are downstream of Prime who are more likely to invest in other climate tech companies. And so we ask them, would you fund this today? And they say no. And if they say no, then we go, great. We'll look at them a little bit further. That's essentially one of the many inputs along with circumstances of the round. So, for instance, has this company been trying to raise and have they been not successful in raising? And then also the question is why? And the answers to the why something might qualify for additionality are things like the founding team is unproven, or there's a lot of tech risk, or there's a big question about, or there might be a binary go or no-go question. So those are the things that we dive deeper into, is not just like, would this be funded, but also what are the reasons why, and is that a risk that philanthropy and Catalytic Capital can play to take on?
The one other thing I'll add to is Prime uses the word catalyze a lot, and it's a word that our office also loves, and you'll probably hear a lot of in the philanthropic space. But part of that, too, is catalyzing a conversation. And so for us, part of that is maybe taking a risk and talking about the things that other people might not want to talk about. So that might look like methane abatement in oil and gas, where it accounts for 25% of all methane in the world. And that equates to over basically 140% of U.S. carbon emissions on an annual basis. It's a lot of emissions. And so how do you have conversations that are tough about how do you abate these sectors that we might not be including in some of the climate conversations, but yet is really important on our shorter 12 to 20 year time scales.
Definitely. And I'd love to transition this into our next kind of question or topic, which is collaboration kind of broadly, like how can philanthropy collaborate effectively with all of these stakeholders? And y'all are giving some examples. I would love to hear more examples that you've seen of really either effective collaboration or places where maybe there's still some friction and we need to kind of grease those wheels. But government is a big one, federal, obviously, but also state and local, the private sector, not just investment, but also corporates and how we're working with those communities, and then obviously the nonprofit space and probably beyond that. But I would love to hear, how do you think philanthropy, like what are the mechanisms by which philanthropy collaborates really effectively? And maybe if you've seen it done really well or have an example, that would be really amazing too.
Yeah, so one example I'll give is it's a little broader than just climate tech, but more in water. For the most part, there's a lot of federal funding coming through the doors, both through the DOE and also IRA, IIJA, a lot of different acronyms. But what that really does is it sends a lot of money to the state organization. So, for example, in Texas, where we're based, there was over $2 billion of water infrastructure funding coming to the state water development board. But that also then is deployed. And so we need to make sure that there's capacity on the ground to make sure that those dollars are used to the best and highest use by the organizations who are in those communities and know how to deploy it best. So what that looked like for us is sitting back as a philanthropist, talking to those who are boots on the ground and seeing, okay, there's a capacity constraint. We're going to build technical assistance so that nonprofits can apply for these grants to actually unlock this large, large government funding that's coming through the door. But a lot of that is looking back and empowering those who do the job day in, day out, and know how to do it, but they just need to grow their resources a little more.
So I was at Department of Energy for a long time, and apologies for how hard it is to get money from the Department of Energy. It sounds like maybe a little bit granular, but for most DOE funding, there's a cost share requirement. And for... it's a really, really tough thing to ask a company to go raise money to get money. And this is, I've seen a very effective use of philanthropy is that just being available to be cost share for early stage R&D awards, just to help get them going. And maybe on that basis, there's leverage that they could, if they're successful, raise more funding. But that cost share requirement, it puts companies in a tough spot. And if there's a way to collaborate and for philanthropic capital to help provide cost share towards a government award, that's a good point of leverage.
Yeah. I'll add one of the things that I really love about many of the funders that we work with is their openness to thinking differently about how philanthropy and reporting and grant applications and all of the things that philanthropy can actually add to the actual burden of doing the work. And these are well-intentioned purposes, right? But for instance, one of the things that I love is that we have some folks that we've worked with who don't need a grant application, don't need grant reporting. We do biannual fund reporting, and that's been sufficient for them. And there's an openness to thinking not just about the money that and the capital that is being provided, but also what are the sort of restrictions associated with that, and what is an openness to how you can keep doing the work well without having to really add on additional labor.
Yeah, definitely. I can also relate to that working at a nonprofit, that can make a really big difference. And there's a sense of why are we doing the things we're doing? Why are we having the relationship we have with people who are in a position of funding us, and making sure that that's really intentional so that it's only kind of conducive to moving the relationship forward. But, you know, I think that, and this actually also, I think, really interestingly transition us into our next topic, because I want to kind of talk broadly just about thinking differently. Before we were talking, Pat, you kept using the phrase, what things that give me heartburn. I always say, what keeps me up at night? And I love all of the, really great examples we've been saying of what we think the opportunity is and where the work is. But I would love to hear now, and I think there's a lot to be said here, where there's some kind of barriers and bottlenecks that are missed opportunities for philanthropy to kind of have the impact that they can have, and how we can think creatively and think differently to address Pat's heartburn and make sure that we're all feeling really positive about the way this is moving and not that it's kind of still kind of finding its footing. So yeah, what do you think are some barriers that philanthropy is positioned to be able to tackle, but maybe isn't quite figured out quite yet?
I think this would be a good time for Margaret to tell us about ECI.
I agree. I would love to hear a little bit more about ECI.
For sure. Yeah. ECI stands for Early Climate Infrastructure. So I alluded to this in my intro. So Prime, as I said, was founded to address the capital gap between venture capital and philanthropy. We essentially had two folks who were standing on both sides of that gap saying things like, I really wish that I could use philanthropic funding to fund these amazing game-changing companies. And then on the other side, there was, I really wish that venture capital could take a risk, but they can't. So that's one capital gap. We are now so if you're thinking about the journey of a company from lab to scale, what we're looking at now is a capital gap between venture and project finance. And so it's a really hard thing to do to bring a company to scale. There's a lot of questions about what is the best type of funding mechanism that we can use here? How can we use catalytic capital to de-risk what might be? And then there's these other perspectives around what if we could bring in project financiers, insurers, other types of folks who can help build the entire type of capital, but also thinking through like how much more complex it is in early climate infrastructure. There's a lot more players once you get past sort of, in Azolla, we were funding companies that were essentially like, maybe one person at the time we invested them. And now in ECI, it's like, oh, no, there's actually like a lot of money on the line, a lot of types of people, all with the different incentives. But philanthropy can actually help unlock what you can do within that space.
Yeah, and this was the source of heartburn that we were talking about, like this particular stage, that when you have companies that have got to this point, they've done a successful pilot. We know this is possible. But it is still pretty far from the level of maturity that this could plausibly get project finance. And the only choice is to go out and raise more venture. And that's a really high cost of capital. It just puts a company in a really, really tough spot. And that's what gives me heartburn, is a lot of great technologies going out and raising more and more venture in an environment that it's more and more difficult to raise that venture. And it just boxes them in that there's really only one way out. So what I appreciate what Prime is doing and a lot of other folks, this conversation really is moving along now at this first of a kind or early project stage of thinking about creative ways to really address that excess risk of how we get over the hump from something that's post-pilot but still pre-commercial. And I guess, as I said earlier, I don't think it's the role for philanthropy to finance an entire project, but there is an ecosystem to plug into. And what we really need to do is identify the excess risk of why is it that an insurer won't underwrite this project? Why is it that an EPC won't take on this project, engineering and procurement and construction company? If we can find targeted ways of addressing that excess risk, we could just get the flywheel going and get more projects going. And my whole priority here is more projects sooner. I have my opinions about which technologies I'm most excited about, but I think I need to check my own opinions at the door here and say, things aren't moving quickly enough. We need more projects sooner. And I'd like to be agnostic and just see more technologies get to scale faster because we're way behind schedule.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's, you know, we were talking about this, but like the volume of carbon that we have in our projections that we think that we need to be, if we want to hit our 2050 goals or 2020, that's based on the assumption that a lot of companies are going to get to scale, or a lot of companies that are just barely piloting are going to actually be successful. And that we're really kind of running a lot of risk, assuming that based on what we have right now, that all of those companies are going to get to scale at a scale in the market where they're actually having their impact potential. That's not probably what's going to happen with a lot of these companies. I think a lot of them will be successful, but they're startups. And so we need to open the top of the funnel a lot wider. But I think right now, like you said, because of we've kind of really focused in on, okay, that first step, that very, very top of the funnel is wide. And then we kind of have this like super quick drop into a really narrow part when companies get past just those early like benchtop demonstration and into the pilot and then into scaling. So I think that that's exactly right. We need to hit these goals, we need a whole lot more companies. We need a lot more shots on goal, basically. And I do think philanthropy has an important role to play in getting us through that whole phase. Yeah, Margaret.
Oh, I just want to call out the report that Prime released a couple of years ago on the barriers to the timely deployment of climate infrastructure, which has formed the basis for a lot of our work in this. I didn't write it, so please don't ask me a lot of questions about it. But it's really robust, and there's a lot of information about the different kinds of capital gaps that are present within the space. And I think it's actually advanced a lot since then, too. So that's something that I would love to talk to you more about.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
And
yeah, Olivia.
The one other thing I'll say is I think a lot of philanthropists, it is an unknown space. And so for us, I have the approach of there's no stupid questions. So I'm going to ask Margaret a million and one questions that maybe are evident, but I don't know them. And I think it's the ability and the willingness from a philanthropy perspective to make sure that we're asking those questions no matter what, to expand our perspective about what is or is not possible.
Definitely. And I would be curious, too, to build on that. One of the things that we have talked about is how we're measuring and assessing. And like you said earlier, Pat, it's kind of like very, very hard to do. And it's a little bit ultimately like intellectually squishy. But I do think that there is a role that philanthropy can play in creating, kind of taking that first step and creating some standards or some kind of baseline understanding of how we're thinking about impact in climate tech. And so I'd be really interested, one, in how you in-house, and we've touched on this a little already, but if anything you want to add about how you in-house do this, either at Lyda Hill or at Schmidt, or if you have more to add about Prime, but then also kind of more on a meta level, like what can philanthropy do to drive forward the problem we're having right now of not, you know, people out in space saying, well, I don't know how to think about this, so there's nothing I can do about it. Like there's no standards and I'm overwhelmed. And so that creates a lot of paralysis, I think. So yeah, I would be really curious how you're thinking about it and then also where you see opportunities to unlock this more broadly.
So we are values aligned impact measurement, so it's all in-house. And the reason for that is because every sector is very different as to what those baselines are. And what we've seen though is that there's still a lot of work for philanthropy to fund science to actually create those baselines. So we've seen this in a lot of carbon accounting. There's a lot of ambiguity still, and that's really slowing the market down. At the same time, for example, the wildfire that's happening in Texas, the Smokehouse Fire, it's a huge wildfire. There's a lot of carbon credits that are soil credits up in the panhandle. We do not know exactly how a wildfire is impacting those soil carbon credits. But science has the ability to do that, and that's where philanthropy can come in and start understanding what is the baseline threshold for measurement, and also how can we all start having at least a conversation around it and be sitting at a table wondering, here are the metrics that we're at least comparing, what are you comparing, and how do we start having some sort of standard, at least on a sector level, but it's going to vary by sector, location, et cetera.
And it's a separate initiative that I'm involved in, but this is outside of the technology program on the science of the carbon cycle. The error bars on those questions are so large that we really do need actually some fundamental scientific, both in measurement and modeling, to actually understand the impact, especially if we're going to talk about nature-based solutions. So that's one area, and I think that that's just a case of getting greater certainty on the impact of certain interventions on the carbon cycle. From the technology side of the question, I guess I've made my peace with, I don't think I'm ever going to get a clear answer on an individual project. So I'm looking more in the aggregate as to, look, before we get to gigatons, we have to go through megatons, and we're not doing megaton projects. So that's really my standard for impact is, as it is right now, you can count on one hand. What are we doing at the megaton level? If we can get that to a level where we're doing dozens of megaton projects, and hopefully some of those turn into tens of megatons, and hopefully some of those turn into 100 megatons, probably not individual projects, but for technologies deployed worldwide. Seeing that acceleration is the impact that we're looking for. I'm guilty of this myself as an engineer, of trying to dig into the weeds of a particular technology of, is this itself a gigaton solution that's going to take over the world? And I am now very consciously thinking about, at the project level, has this technology reached a point where we've got a project that makes sense, that will pencil out, and that we will see what the next project and how that will scale. But we need to do more of these projects and get those shots on goal to even get that answer. So yeah, that's definitely. It just, there's a learn by doing aspect of getting that impact question.
We say learn by doing a lot at Prime too. I just wanted to add two things here. One of them is that what I really appreciate about what Olivia and Pat said right now is comfort with uncertainty. That's something that I think philanthropy can really bring into the space that others cannot, especially if you're someone within VC who has these extremely specific goals and incentives and metrics that you're measuring yourself against. And I think that's something that philanthropy can bring to bear that others can't. I also want to plug Crane, which is the in-house emissions reduction potential technology tool that we developed in-house at Prime when we were trying to figure out how we would measure what the carbon, the climate impact potential of a company might be or a solution might be. It's open access thanks to philanthropy, and it's available at cranetool.org.
Yeah, a lot of our fellows have used the Crane tool to measure their GHG ERP. So it's a very valuable tool, and it's an incredibly robust tool for the fact that it's free. Like, it's, and it really is such a service that philanthropy did to make that available. Our fellows bring those into meetings with VCs. They put them in their grant applications to the federal government, and it makes a big difference to have something like that available to them. And realistically, at the stage we're working with startups, they're like a founder of one. They're really tight on their finances, and there's no way they could have afforded that otherwise. And so it's a super, super valuable. And I want to call out something a colleague of ours, Jocelyn at Cisco Foundation, said the other day, which I really appreciated. And I think it ties a lot of these things together, which is that one of the risks that philanthropy can take is just creating activity in this space that makes it bigger and draws more attention to it. So even if you fund something or you try something or you experiment in something and it fails as a project or an idea, her argument would have been that it's still a success because you are creating activity in a space that needs more activity. You're drawing attention. You've tested something and now we know that doesn't work and that's valuable too. And I think just in general, that's a type of risk to what you were saying, Margaret, that like, because of the incentives other actors are dealing with, it's not realistic to expect them to take. But philanthropy gets to have a lot more like elbow room in that area to say, we'll try it. We want to be responsible. We're going to be thoughtful and conscientious, but philanthropists are. But we will take a risk that someone else won't take. And just that alone makes like a bigger conversation that right now, again, like we're so far behind. Like we need this conversation to be as big as we can. We need as much activity as we can, even if it's activity that is a little bit, yeah, and dealing with a lot more uncertainty than other actors would be willing to deal with. So I really appreciate, I'd never thought about it that way. Really appreciated that way of thinking about impact and success. Like that's a success. You tried something, you got people talking, you've moved something forward, even if it's just this little bit, because we need a lot of forward momentum right now, way beyond what we've got, even with all of the collective work that everyone's already doing. So yeah, I really appreciated that. So another topic that I'd love to hear you guys comment on, especially coming from kind of such different, a lot of overlap, but such kind of different spaces, is kind of emerging tech, and then also just emerging trends in general in climate tech innovation that you're really excited about, or that you think is really important and doesn't get enough attention right now, or that you think maybe is like the next thing that people should be looking into. So I would, you know, Olivia, if you want to start, I know you had some thoughts on this in particular about wildfires and what's going on with that.
Yeah, so I'm deeply passionate about wildfires, both individually and on a professional level, because it's something that wildfires are solvable. We have mega fires and that can change very quickly. We know how to do it, but we need better, faster technology that can be adopted by practitioners. But that also applies to all of climate adaptation. It's receiving 8% of financing, and yet while we need to do things faster and get to the scale that we need, we're not on track. And so we also need to learn how to live in the state of the world that's happening. And whether that's a wildfire, whether that's a hurricane, whether that's a flood, people are already being impacted, and usually it's the people who emit the least are the ones who are the impacted the most. And so how can we uplift those communities to ensure that they actually have the resources available with new technologies to ensure that they are having a livable future? And so for me, I think wildfires are really interesting because it brings together all different types of industries, whether that's insurance, whether that's utilities, venture. You have all different types of funders and stakeholders in the room that can adopt on a mass scale change for technical solutions that are not wildly capital intensive.
Yeah, definitely.
I would love to bring in, as we talk about early climate infrastructure, also thinking about the people who are impacted by an actual solution once you get steel in the ground. It's something that I'm incredibly passionate about. I have a background in things like how to build a more responsible mineral supply chain at the intersection of human rights and extractives. And that those lessons you can still pull forward from the extractive industry into what we're doing in the climate tech space. It isn't just we need this tech. It's we need this tech because of the people who are in the world. And that's the thing that I think that we can tend to miss sometimes in trends. And I think that's actually something that philanthropy can really play a role in, is also using your voice and using that power to say, let's also think about not just what this company could do in terms of climate, but also what that could mean for the people who live in a space. And how do we be a good neighbor to those people? And how do we think about what this company might actually expand into and go beyond sort of benefits and co-benefits to actually being something that's powerful and a force for good?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Pat.
For an area that I hope can get more attention, and this is on the focus on getting to scale quickly, I really get excited about ideas that can leverage existing supply chains. Whether that's leveraging ag waste is something, but leveraging cleanup of mining waste or other opportunities you can do with tailings. But also retrofitting existing infrastructure. It's not always a very, it's not the sexiest story to go sell investors, but if you can retrofit a coal plant to be something better that's part of the solution, I mean, one, I think that's helpful for that community. So it's a good part of the transition, but it also operates at scale quickly. And that's solutions like that are the ones that at the earlier stage may be a tough sell for some of these technologies to go raise the early stage if you don't have a greenfield technology that can take over the world. But I think there's a potential for a lot of impact with retrofit or leveraging existing infrastructure to make that part of the solution sooner. Those are ideas that I'm interested in.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in this way, too, we talk a lot at Activate about how climate isn't really, I mean, it is a sector, but it's also not really a sector. It's essentially, it's everything. It's totally cross-cutting. It's across all of these different industries in really big ways, which would be direct climate technologies like carbon capture, and then also in really like specific ways, like a different way to build something or a retrofit of something that is actually like, is that climate? We would say yes. Like all of that needs to be happening. We need all of that moving forward in concert. We need a completely different economy and a different way of doing things. And we need, like, it's going to take a lot of scientists and a lot of companies working on all kinds of different problems to do that. And so I feel like that's a great point, Pat. I really appreciate that, because I think it's thinking about this through a lens of not just kind of things that are traditionally climate and if that's exciting and investable, but what is this specific technology doing to either move us forward, not move us anywhere, or potentially obviously move us backward, which we're going to avoid because that's not what we want to do. And so I think another aspect of this, especially since we're talking about innovation is the new thing that's happening right now. It's exciting. It's a lot of first of their kind technologies, which is also part of why they can be really hard to evaluate and invest in and figure out how to finance, because there's just no kind of real comps. But I would love to hear y'all talk about how philanthropy can think about the long term, kind of the sustainability and the long term impact of the investments. So yes, we need to get a lot of stuff out the door really soon, but also how do you weigh that against kind of the long-term impact that philanthropy is trying to have, that's going to outlive their founders, outlive all of the people who are working on it today, hopefully take the next generations forward when we all survive and don't have a climate apocalypse. So yeah, I would be really curious to think how you guys in your own jobs think about this, or in your own organizations think about this.
I think about climate apocalypse a lot, just to be clear. Yeah, I think about, and you know, this is also, Prime is a nonprofit, so we run on general operating grants. That is how Prime works. And one of the things that I think about a lot in terms of that is like, what do we do if general operating grants run out. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think about that. I think about what do we do if people step back and step away from things that where their values are aligned. These are the things that keep me up at night, really. And I don't know that I have the best answer, but what I love in about talking to people who really care and have something to give, whether that's capital or another type of resource, is thinking expansively about the sort of optimism that you can have in the space, even though it's hard and climate doomism is extremely real, but also thinking about what gives me hope is the people that I work with and the people who really care about this work. So I think that's actually where I go, is like, how do we turn this from just sort of the different capital stacks, but also into community, into partnership, into people, and thinking about that as the core of what everything that we're doing, as opposed to sort of these other incentives and metrics, which are really hard to measure, but also like we can do it if we do it together. I am a climate optimist sometimes.
Yeah, totally. No, I say all the time, the best part about my job is that it is all good news. Like if I look at the actual news, there's a lot going on. But when I go into work, I am working with the people who saw the problem and said, I can fix that. And we're working with hundreds of them. And they are out there. They are doing incredible work. And it's extremely, it keeps my climate optimism alive. Like those people are out there. And what we're talking about today is how do we make sure that they're supported and we keep them moving forward and we get more people into that space. And part of that is inspiring scientists now to say, I'm in the lab, I'm working on something. What futures are possible to me? What could I do with this? Do I stay in academia? Maybe. But what if I took it and made it a product or a business? How could I do that? Is there a future in that? Or is that just like am I just going to blow up my life? And so we're really trying to get more people talking about this and thinking about this. This is a space that can grow. But I do think that it is one that right now, still, there's a lot of work to be done in reaching scientists kind of earlier in the pipeline, even at the PhD or postdoc stage, who, you know, we'll go do recruitment events in universities that aren't, you know, that are like aren't MIT, you know, and they'll be like, oh, I never even thought about that. It never occurred to me my idea could be a company. And so there's a lot of advocacy work, I think, that needs to be done. We're all doing it and we're trying to make that happen. But I think that broadly, just to get more scientists to realize this is an option for them to really have a huge impact. And there are lots of people out there. Four of them are on this stage who want to support them to do that. It's obviously a lot bigger than us. Yeah, I mean, another thing, Olivia, you had been talking earlier about also just kind of like buyer market fit and being able to learn from other industries. I'd be curious if you could share a little bit about your thinking on that.
Yeah, so our organization also funds in biotech, and there's a lot of crossover in the sense of in biotech and in climate tech, you have valleys of death. And so what we've seen is that philanthropy can really serve as the bridges to opportunity, and how do you make sure that we're actually able to scale and leverage both government funding to philanthropic funding to industry funding and bringing together all in a conversation to make sure that we're using capital as efficiently as possible. And that has not been optimized in biotech, but what it shows to me is that we're willing to take the risk if we're having the conversation. And so making sure that you have the conversation in climate tech is pivotal, but also making sure that you're bringing all of these stakeholders in the room. And the difference being that in biotech, it's really clear there's an illness. And you get a lot of buy-in in biotech because someone personally was affected by said illness. You have an investor across the table who has someone in their wheelhouse that has been affected. They are bought in on why it's a risk. That is not necessarily the case with climate. And so it's also making sure, to your point, Courtney, that climate is not just viewed as a sector, it's viewed as a risk lens across all of these different sectors that we need to account for, and that there is also a balance sheet and there is a total for that risk that we need to be making sure that we're accounting and able to see pretty clearly.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this also touches on what both of you guys have mentioned at different points about the most vulnerable populations and having their voice be brought to the front, because as is now well known, but has could have been known kind of more broadly much sooner, the people who are suffering the most and having the most negative impacts from climate change are those who contributed the least to it, and also who tend to be very vulnerable already for other reasons. And I think the role that like you guys said, it's such an important role for philanthropy to bring those voices forward and bring them into the conversation, because I'm not sure that the market's naturally going to do that. It's not always been good at that. And so to really demand and insist that those voices be heard and that those people and those populations be considered is such an important role, because, you know, we started even the conversation and just the influence philanthropy has. Philanthropy, there's tens of billions of dollars every year just going out the door, let alone what is kind of out there in assets. And that is a lot of influence. And so I think that that's one of the most kind of inflection point spaces where philanthropy can make a huge difference in something that otherwise potentially wouldn't be emphasized by other players. Maybe, but I think there's a really big role to play there. Okay, so another topic that I'd like to touch on is to what extent philanthropy has a role to play in or the interaction with shaping policy in the climate space. So I would be interested maybe in places where you see there being kind of a breakdown right now, or also where you see it working well, or opportunities. But I think, again, philanthropy has an enormous amount of influence to exert. So they have the influence. How are they using it? Not just kind of, yes, we want to definitely work at the grassroots level, like you mentioned, Olivia, boots on the ground. But the system that we're in creates the incentives that have the results we have. So how are we also kind of attacking this from both directions, looking up as well and saying, okay, at the systems level, at the policy level, these things need to change. So yeah, I'd be curious any of y'all's thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I'll just say for our foundation, we don't do any lobbying. So we're a C3, or not a C3, we're a private foundation. We don't do any lobbying. So when it comes to like directly influencing policy, that's not that's not part of our toolkit. We do work in communities when it comes to advocating for or against projects based on the needs of the community. I think that that's probably the most important piece for where the policy directly impacts the technology, the community, and something coming together. I guess in the biggest picture, the policy that comes out of Congress, I'm very pleasantly surprised that the IRA exists, and we're trying to do our best to leverage all of the possibilities that came out of that. And I guess to some degree, we're just thankful that that happened, so that there's something we can do. And not looking a gift horse here. We got to get a move on.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great point. And I think also as a nonprofit, Activate's in a similar position. And a big piece of what we do is just advocacy, right? We're just naming things. We're meeting with people. We're talking to them about topics that maybe as a legislator or a different kind of a government worker, they have not thought about or heard about or talked to someone directly about who knows a lot about it. So I think that that stuff that we similarly as a nonprofit find that that's a really valuable role that we can play. And I guess then kind of maybe pulling back the lens even more broadly, would love to hear kind of in any way, like lessons learned or success stories from the work that you've done in the climate space and advancing climate technology and innovation. What have you seen that worked super, super well? Where have you seen either your own organization or one that you admire have a really high impact and have tried something new, something that really made a big difference and that you think is something that the rest of us can all learn from?
The big thing that's coming to mind for me is that willingness to fail and willingness to try. It's so hard to be an entrepreneur. In Western society, we're not socialized to fail. We're socialized to perform and to produce. And so that's the thing that I'm always really impressed by is when there's a company that says, we see a problem here, I'm going to give it a shot and I'm going to build something cool. And then also I'm going to do everything I can in my power to bring it to fruition. I will think for a moment about particular companies, but I do want to give a hat tip to a lot of the amazing Prime Impact Fund and Azolla Ventures companies that exist. The tagline we like to use is from fungus to fusion. So there's just everything out there just thinking through what are the different sort of capital gaps that exist and also what are the sort of different market gaps and what was it like you know, 10 years ago when I didn't work at Prime and how hard it was to actually start things back then. So that willingness to fail is really what comes to mind for me about how to bring things to life.
Absolutely. No, I one of my favorite things to talk about Activate companies is from the very first cohort we ever had in 2015, fellows were working on things like carbon transformation. And truly back then, that doesn't seem that long ago, but people were like, that's not real. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. And now one of our alumni companies, 12, is one of the biggest companies working in this. And now it feels obvious. Oh, sure. Yeah. Like 12. Cool. Of course, we're going to make stuff out of carbon. But it was not like that when we started with that company. People told them that was not real. And there's a woman here today, Caitlin Suarez. She's the CEO and co-founder of TerraWatts. And I was just talking to someone with her last night about, she's a new company. She's been in our program for 1 year. She's helping, I mean, she would explain it so much better, but basically wireless transmission of power underground. And before she came to us, and still sometimes, but definitely before she came to us, people would say, that's not real. Like, that's sci-fi. That doesn't exist. And Activate and other philanthropic organizations and other people who want to work in this early space said, well, we are going to look at the fundamentals. We see that there's something here. We believe in you. And we think that you should try it. Take this risk. It's an enormous amount of personal risk. But a lot of people will tell these scientists, oh, that you can't do that. Now it's easy in hindsight to say, of course they could do it. But at the time, it's really not. And so I really love that, Margaret. I do feel like that willingness to say, we're going to stand with the people who will take enormous risks. And we will support them to see that through and see what can come of it. And we're willing to go with them on that journey. I think that that's a huge role. So I really appreciate you calling that out, because we've got a lot of people like that in our portfolio too that I'm always super excited to share about. But yeah, I would, you know, Olivia, Pat, other kind of lessons learned, success stories?
Maybe one lesson is just that I've said it a few times. I'm an engineer. I have my strong opinions about what's the best choices are going to be. And I've been wrong more often than I've been right. So I think some humility when looking at technologies and thinking about, well, what can this be 5, 10, 20 years down the road? That's another one of these unknowable questions. There are so many variables that are impossible to predict. So much of it is going to be dependent on policy regimes. So I guess to me, a lesson there is not to sharpen the pencil so much at the very beginning. If something is a good idea, to give it a shot and give enough resources to get an answer and be willing to take the risk that it's not going to work on the 10-year time horizon, but not to kill something by, modeling and analysis for unknowable questions before you even have a chance to answer those questions. So I think it's just a different flavor of the risk is maybe suspending disbelief on the earliest stage ideas for some things that I would have told you couldn't have worked. Same story you just told there for 12. Some things that do work that the conventional wisdom was wrong.
12 was a prime syndication company. I just want to call that out.
Well, and I, Margaret and Olivia, I feel like we were talking about this earlier, but the idea that, I mean, yes, these are first of their kind technologies. We don't necessarily know a lot about them, but there's an opportunity to kind of pool the knowledge and pool the risk on understanding the tech and bringing in experts who can give us a sense of what's going on here and enough information that at least the highest risk, you know, the organizations, hopefully philanthropy with the highest risk tolerance, feel like they have enough information to go on. And so I think that was a really interesting point too, that this is something that, you know, at the small family office level, that can feel really overwhelming. Like, how, I mean, there's only a handful of people in here and we just don't have the resources. So how do we work together? I feel like there's a real opportunity there to work together to say, how are we kind of sharing our understanding so that we can remove that barrier for philanthropy that doesn't have an enormous amount of resources to do that kind of due diligence at these really early stages. So yeah, appreciated that point as well. But yeah.
The other call out I'll make is just to Pat's point with humility, that also goes with making sure you're empowering those who are the experts in the room. So that's us partnering with Prime. That's us partnering with Rocky Mountain Institute when it comes to methane abatement. That's our organization and philanthropies partnering with those who are experts in this space and empowering them to do what they do best. And that's where the trust-based philanthropy really comes into play and making sure that we're operating off the mentality of we're investing in you because we trust that you know exactly what you're doing. While we might not be the experts in the field, you are. So it's kind of being the intermediary of betting on the expert when you're not the expert.
Yeah, definitely. And just, I think philanthropy, because of the impact focus, can play a really special role there. We have finalist week, we're picking new candidates for our fellowship, and we bring a lot of different stakeholders into those rooms when they make a presentation. And the kinds of questions we get, for example, from VCs in those rooms are really different than the kinds that we get from other scientists or from people in the public sector. And I think that's because VCs aren't positioned, they're not ready to understand how to evaluate these scientists and their technologies. Like, they need a trust-based relationship at this early stage to be able to get it to a point where a structure that we have, like venture capital, can really engage with it, and the scientist is prepared to hold their own, not because they didn't have the tech before, but because that's a growth path in its own right as a CEO and a founder.
Yeah, I love that. I also want to add just two other things around patience. That's one of the things that philanthropy can provide, patience and risk tolerance. And then one of the other things that I love about working in climate is just that it's such a big tent and it is all hands on deck. And so there's a lot of collaboration that happens formally and informally, partnering on things like diligence, people who volunteer with Prime saying, yeah, I want to like dig deeper into this weird specific thing that you're looking at. That's the kind of thing that I really appreciate, is it's not gatekeepy as much as other sectors I've worked inside, where it's let's get together and work together on these hard problems, because we need everyone in the room, everyone in the tent.
Absolutely. And there's an increasing, maybe it should have been higher sooner, but we are finally getting to the increasing sense of urgency that we have got to do this, and we've got to do it faster, bigger, and better than we've ever done it before. And so it is all hands on deck, and I love that collaboration. And unfortunately, we're winding down. We've only got a few minutes left. So speaking of collaboration, I want to have a chance for everyone to share like a final thought, if that's something that you'd like to do. But first, I just want to take the opportunity to say an enormous thank you, both, of course, for being here today. This has been a really interesting conversation, and I feel like we could dive so much deeper in any one of these topics, but also for being wonderful partners to us, but also to, as we're talking collaboratively, lots of other players in this space. I feel like this is an example of three organizations who are really bringing this space together and making things possible. And so I'm grateful for that, just for the world. And then I'm also really grateful that we get to benefit from partnering with your organizations as well, just being in that tent together. So thank you very much. But yeah, would love to hear any kind of closing thoughts before we close out.
Yeah, so I'll share kind of the guiding principle that guides our office as we think through this really massive problem, is do what others can't do and won't do, not what they can and will do. And that was a quote by Warren Buffett that he said to Lida when she signed the Giving Pledge. And it's something that really guides us as we tackle these really big problems. And while they can be overwhelming and seem almost impossible, it's the impossible problems that keep us up every day and are the things that get us out of bed. And so doing that with other people makes it possible, and that collaboration is pivotal in how we move forward.
I love that, because what I was going to say is that everyone has power. Even if you aren't a philanthropist and don't have capital to give or resources to give, everyone has power, everyone has a role to play in this, and I think it's the folks that work on climate who say every job is a climate job. So I just want to say that there are things that folks can do inside of the spheres of influence that they're in towards climate, even if it isn't specific to climate tech and philanthropy.
I guess my last thought will be, this next stage of what we're facing, you know, through 2030, we really need to be focused on doing things at scale, which is a lot of different problems than what we've been tackling for the last 5 years. So I think that a lot of the work that you all have done, the early stage of the pipeline is healthier than it was 5 years ago because of some of the experiments that we tried. We need new experiments to see how do we get these things to scale, because venture will take us so far, but it's not going to take us all the way to 100. And we need new tools and new experiments to get us there.
Absolutely. I mean, those are all such excellent closing thoughts. The only thing I want to add, and it crosses all of that, is there is hope. There is an enormous amount of hope. There are really dedicated people working on this every day, and they're brilliant, and they have the passion, the resources, and the ability to solve these problems and to get us out of this crisis. And I really, I think that that is like the biggest takeaway that I want to have, is that there's hope, and that that hope should motivate everyone, including philanthropy, but certainly everyone who is in this room and everyone who hears this and everyone in the world, to be able to kind of feel very optimistic about the outcome that we can make possible if we're all pulling together on this problem. So thank you very much. Thank you very much to our audience for being with us today. It's been wonderful to have you with us. We appreciate your time.